The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Is the audio okay? Is it on? It doesn't sound very loud to me, but if it's okay with you guys, it's okay. Everybody's shaking their head. Okay. So, we all have the desire to be happy. Maybe that's so obvious it doesn't even need to be said. Maybe we can even expand it that not only we as in humans, but maybe even all creatures desire to be happy. If we kind of loosen up that word desire and loosen up that word happy, right? There's all this movement or this wish or for greater well-being and ease and freedom and peace. And so this desire, this wish for happiness is a natural part of life. It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere in all parts of life and certainly in our lives. Yet sometimes in some Buddhist teachings, you can get the idea or the sense that desire is a bad thing. It's a source of suffering. Some teachers, the way in which they teach, there's that emphasis. But I'd like to take a different tact and to look at things a little bit differently, especially in light of the recognition that desire is such a natural part of our lives. So how can we work with it? Do we even need to work with it? How can we harness the power of desire, as well as how can we not get trampled over by the power of desire? Maybe one place we can start is to look at pleasure. Because pleasure sometimes gets confused with desire, and sometimes pleasure gets confused with happiness. So we have this desire to be happy, and pleasure is somehow in the mix there. So maybe I'd like to say that there definitely can be pleasure, like sense pleasure, that is beneficial and supportive of our practice and of our lives. Pleasure can be an integral, I hope it is an integral part of all of our lives. But it requires a little bit of skill or some discernment to how can we work with pleasure in a way that it really supports our life. For me, I'll say that this summer I spent more time than I usually do outside in nature. And there's something about, and I knew this when I was younger, right? But then I got really busy and I don't know, I just had the opportunity this summer to spend more time with the trees and with the water and just walking, hiking. And there's a certain like softening I discovered of whatever hardness there was, kind of a slowing down, maybe a sense of awe, appreciation, some ease. This type of pleasure I discovered, and I think it's true probably for all of us, can really support a good life, help us to not be always going and getting caught up or lost or frantic. But a pleasure that helps us to slow down and to appreciate. And maybe in this, I like this word awe. To kind of have a sense of awe. Of course, pleasure doesn't have to be only nature. Some really nice music or art or watching the dance or even performing dance. These are ways that there's like a way of communicating that can be different, and it can be communicating something that's important and meaningful, even if we don't really have words for it or we don't know what it is exactly. Like there's something really special that happens when you hear some music or see some art that really touches you. And it may be different for all of us. So definitely pleasure with music, art, nature, as well as meditation. There can be, or there are, meditative states that are really pleasurable, where you have some settling down and it just feels like such a relief, like, oh. It doesn't always happen. Sometimes our meditations are always busy, and it may take going on a residential retreat. It may take days of meditation before that happens, but it is possible to feel this settledness and an exquisite kind of contentment. It's like, yes, I'm just here doing this, just meditating here and now. Sometimes it takes a few days before our minds kind of let go of all the busyness. There's even in the Buddhist teachings the appointing towards the role of pleasure and happiness. I call this the gladness pentad. It's these five experiences that tend to happen one after the other, and we see them throughout all kinds of different places in the Buddhist teachings. And there's different ways in which to start these five, in which to start the first one. And then after the five, there's different places where the sixth step could go. So the first one is gladness. Often it arises maybe with inspiration. You hear something inspiring that it feels, I don't know, like it's like an alignment with something deep and true inside of yourself. Gladness can also arise with behaving in a way that feels like the right thing to do. May not have been the easiest or the most comfortable, but the right thing to do. There's a certain gladness with that. And then in this gladness pentad, gladness leads to joy. Then joy leads to tranquility. And tranquility leads to happiness. And then happiness leads to concentration. And then within concentration, there's again joy, happiness, and contentment, like a radical contentment that's available when there's, as I said, some settling down. So this idea of pleasure can really be a part of our life. And I hope it is a part of all of your lives. But there can also be suffering associated with pleasure, right? With overindulgence. If one cookie is good, 10 cookies must be better. You know, that kind of thing. Or whatever it may be, right? There can be some overindulgence. And we also need to learn for ourselves, what is the difference between just indulgence, regular indulgence, and self-care? When are we using pleasure to support our lives? And when are we using pleasure to avoid something else? When are we using pleasure to, maybe it's very often to avoid something else? So this is something we learn, right? This is part of maturing as a person, is like, okay, so what is the role of pleasure, and what is a way to experience it and pursue it that makes sense for me? And I'm sure all of you have the same experience that I do, that as I get older, what was pleasurable when I was younger is not so pleasurable, is not as pleasurable now. Now I like things that I didn't like when I was younger. An example that I gave the other night when I was teaching the hindrance course, and I think I've maybe even said it here too, but this had such a big impact on me that it served something for me to remember. It's a very simple example that when I was young, there was very popular to have, like when I was a kid, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old or something, there's these Hershey chocolate bars. And my parents, so that my brother and I have these chocolate bars as a treat, like if we I don't know, it was special occasions or something like this. So this was a big deal, these Hershey chocolate bars. And of course, I loved them. And then, as I, many years later, probably in my early 20s, I experienced chocolate that had come from Belgium. It's like, wow, what a difference. For me, like this Hershey's chocolate bar, okay, that was okay then, but now that I know about these Belgian chocolates, I just kind of shifted, right? Everything changes in perspective, or it changes, it becomes relative. So we have these types of experiences. The same thing with meditation. As our meditation practice grows, we can start to see more and more settledness. What we used to think is settled, then we often discover, oh, there's a little more settledness underneath it that's even possible. A little bit more spaciousness that's possible. For me, it's quite amazing. The more I meditate, to keep on finding, oh, yeah, there's just a little bit more and more. Just when you think that it's, you feel perfectly content, you know, just to find that, yeah, there's even more contentment possible. You start to see kind of the subtle, really subtle restlessness or things like this. So I would say that a big part of Buddhist practice is about discerning skillful pleasure from unskillful pleasure, part of what I just described, but also skillful desire from unskillful desire. It's a big part of the what we would say is wisdom, is knowing, like, what is the way to work with desire? What kind of desire is helpful and useful for us to use? So maybe we can start with some general definitions. Okay, skillful desire. Well, how would we know what is skillful? Here's some things to think about. We often have, as I said, the desire to be happy. If it's a skillful desire, it will make you happy. But then we can look at that happiness and we can look at that desire. But first, we can just see, are these things that we're following, these inclinations, these things that sometimes push us, are they leading to things that make us happy? Sometimes we don't really take the time to examine that or to consider that. Maybe sometimes following these desires, or maybe even being pushed around by these desires, has become a habit, or has become, we're not even aware of it. So we can look, just see, do they make us happy? And then, of course, our sense of what happiness is will shift. For example, maybe if somebody is, I don't know, yelling at us or saying things that are very unpleasant towards us, we may think that not harboring thoughts of retribution is skillful, right? That's like, this is a big step for us to, before we would have thought like, oh, this is terrible and I better show this person and, you know, kind of made up a big story about what we're going to do. And then when we, maybe with practice, this person does whatever they do to make us angry, yell at us or whatever it might be, and we don't have those type of actions, that feels like, okay, that's skillful. And I feel definitely I have some more happiness here, some more ease. But maybe with more practice, what we start to see is rather than this absence of retribution or ideas of retribution or this absence of no longer getting quite as caught up, maybe we start to have compassion for this person, like, wow, There's a lot of suffering there if this person is yelling at us or doing whatever they're doing. So maybe I think having compassion is probably a little bit more skillful. So our ideas of skillfulness and our ideas of what's happiness, we shift as we practice. So this provisional, It's relative. And I like this idea. We start where we are. It's not like we have to behave a particular way or have something be a particular way. We start where we are. It's more skillful. Can we go in that direction with our desires? Another way to measure whether a desire is skillful, does it cause harm to you or to others? Does following this desire, is it beneficial to others or is it harmful to others? Or maybe it's neutral to others and to yourself. To be really skillful, it has to be not harmful either to others or towards yourself. And of course, this is the basics or the basis for ethical behavior and the ethical teachings in the Buddhist practice. Right? It's skillful to behave with ethics, not to harm others. And there's this expression, which I have found to be true. I like this expression just maybe because it has this alliteration, but the bliss of blamelessness. There's a lot of ease. You realize, you know, I don't actually have anything to worry about, that I haven't done anything really bad. Yes, there's those things that I did, you know, earlier or something, but, you know, right now I think I'm doing as best that I can. And that gives a person a lot of confidence and a lot of ease. Instead of this kind of like shame or like, oh, that there was that thing that I did that I don't feel good about and I hope nobody reminds me of it or wants to get retribution on me for it or something like this. So this bliss of blamelessness. So we can know if our desire is skillful, if it causes us to do actions that actually lead to happiness. It doesn't cause harm. And then this is something that we often, in the Buddhist teachings, we often don't emphasize. But desire is part of right effort. Many of you may know right effort. It's the sixth step and the Eightfold Path. And it's a part of this path towards freedom, towards liberation, towards the greatest ease, happiness. Sometimes it's mahasukha. The greatest happiness is like how awakening is described. So desire is a part of one of these steps, this step called right effort. So this is kind of my translation here. So in this description of what is right effort, here's the technical language of what it is. There's the case where a practitioner generates desire, endeavors, activates persistence, and upholds and exerts their intent for the sake of guarding against unwholesome states, for the sake of abandoning any unwholesome state that already exists, for the sake of arousing wholesome states, and for the sake of maintaining any wholesome states that already exist. So right effort has what to do when you find unwholesome or unskillful states. A, try to prevent them from arising, but if they're already arisen, see if you can lessen them. And for wholesome states, see what you can do to get them to arise. And once they've arisen, what can you do to maintain them? But it's interesting that the word here, to generate desire and endeavor and activate persistence. So this word desire in Pali is chanda. Sometimes gets translated as zeal. I kind of like this word. It's not a common word. It's not in my vocabulary usually to use this word zeal. But I like this idea, kind of like a zeal has maybe a sense of delight to it as well, as, you know, enthusiasm for it. But it also has this sense of, right, you're going a particular direction if you have a zeal. So an integral part of the Eightfold Path is right effort, and part of right effort is to harness our desire, to generate desire, or having a commitment, maybe we could say, to work with unwholesome states and wholesome states. Again, because these will make us happy in terms of they will help us have greater ease, right? If we're diminishing the unwholesome and increasing the wholesome. And there's also, of course, in the Buddhist, in the suttas, in the scriptures, I guess we could say, there's stories of some unskillful desire. And one story is of King Ajatasattu. He was a king, and we find him being described in the other sacred literature of other religions at the same time in ancient India. So in the Jains and the Brahmanical literature, as well as in the Buddhists. So he probably was an actual historical figure if these three different religious groups maintain this. And they all refer to this particular story. That doesn't say this specifically, but my assumption is he had this tremendous desire for money, sex, and power. He was a prince of a country. In order to have more power, he wanted to be the king. And who was the king already? His father. But he really wanted to be the king. Off with his head. I don't know if he actually decapitated, but he killed his own father in order so that he could become king sooner. And then throughout the suttas, he starts war with some of the neighboring countries, and he goes to the Buddha. He even asks for advice. How can I help conquer these neighboring countries over here? The Buddha doesn't give him advice. And then there's a story where one night he can't sleep. I mean, not surprising, right? He can't sleep, and he asks his ministers, you know, is there anybody who can help me find some ease? And some of his ministers say, oh, you should go talk to this religious person. No, go talk to this religious person. No. What we learn later in the story is that the king had already talked to all these people. And then finally one person says, oh, well, there's the Buddha. You should go talk to the Buddha. So King Ajatasattu, why I said money, sex, and power, because he brings 500 wives with him. That's a lot of people, right? Brings 500 wives on 500 elephants. And he's on his own elephant. So here's 501 elephants. I mean, that's what a grand display, right, of power and wealth. If you have this huge entourage that goes to see the Buddha. The Buddha is with many, many, many monks, and they're sitting there meditating. And as the king is starting to approach, it's so quiet with all these monks meditating. The king gets really afraid, right? He's kind of agitated, and he's so used to busyness and I don't know, whatever is around being a king. He feels nervous and uneasy with all these people that have ease. And he asks the Buddha, he says, so there are these craftsmen and farmers, and I forget the list, something like this. He says, they all do activities in the world, and there's fruits of their activities. There's tangible benefits that are visible here and now. What do you guys have? What kind of benefits do you guys have for meditating? It doesn't seem like to be tangible benefits. And then the Buddha gives a very long teaching about the gradual training of finding a way towards liberation. And the Buddhist keeps on giving him, well, this is a benefit, this is a benefit. And through this, the king starts to see, like, oh yeah, there is a way to find some ease. And there are consequences to our actions. This is part of a key Buddhist teaching as well, right? So through the power of the Buddha, the king, he starts to relax a little bit. And so some of the scholars and Dharma teachers will say, well, at the end of this, the king starts to relax and he confesses that, in fact, he had killed his father. And the Buddha hears his confession. And then the king feels fantastic. And I think the Buddha says something like, may you act with restraint in the future. So the scholars and Dharma teachers, it's not clear, was he asking for forgiveness or was he just making a confession or what that's about? But it shows that here's somebody who is so troubled by following his desires and had gotten to the pinnacle, right? If you're the king and you have 500 wives on 500 elephants, you probably have exhausted all sources of desire and trying to find everything for happiness and spoke to all these other religious teachers before finally coming to talk to the Buddha. So I don't know if this is intended to be a story in the suttas about there's no gaining unlimited worldly accoutrements or acquiring things is not the way to happiness. But maybe with, I don't know, maybe some modern psychological ideas, we could say that the king represents everything that's possible in the outside world, having mastery of your environment as much as possible. Whereas the Buddha represents having mastery over the inner world, your kind of your self-mastery. And the king was the one who couldn't sleep at night and was agitated and had talking to his ministers and bringing all the wives. And here's the Buddha who's sitting calmly with all these monks who are sitting calmly. So this mastery of the world finally discovers or learns or that actually the answers to happiness is with the inner mastery. So the story of King Ajatasattu is a kind of desire that goes wrong. Somebody who's taken this kind of maybe pleasure and desire, unskillful pleasure and desire to their limits and didn't find ease. Maybe I'll say as a little addendum, guess what happened to him? He killed his father. His son kills him, right? It's terrible. This is the story of this happens here. Yeah, maybe it's karma, right? So part of the Buddhist practice is to really learn this difference between skillful desire and unskillful desire. But there's also desire, even if it is skillful, it can be a hindrance. We can, even if we have this desire to help others, it can be a hindrance if we can't put it down when it's time to put it down. It can be a hindrance if it prevents us from seeing clearly what's really happening. You know, sometimes if we are driven by a desire, we're just driven, and we're not really seeing what's happening around us or what's happening within us. And we're maybe not even seeing what our object of our desire is. So desire can be, even if it may be skillful, it can be a hindrance. It can get in the way of some things that we want to do. The obvious ones are, in the Buddhist teachings, of course, are the five hindrances, which are make it difficult to settle down in meditation. This is if you're finding that your mind is not settling down, I'll just use that word, Probably it's one of the hindrances that are active, and desire is one of the five typical ones. I'll just say quickly that the five hindrances is kind of the Buddhist way of kind of boiling down into five categories. Everything that is not, or everything that like is an obstacle to getting concentrated or getting settled or seeing clearly. First one, sensual desire. Second one, aversion. Third one, restlessness and worry. Or maybe it's sloth and torpor. I don't remember. I'll say it's this one. Restlessness and worry. So that's, you know, having your energy zoom, go, go, go. And the fourth one is sloth and torpor, which is the opposite, kind of collapsing, not having enough energy. And then the fifth hindrance is skeptical doubt. So feeling hesitant, like, should I do this? Well, maybe I should do that. Oh, I don't know. And maybe I should be doing Sufi dancing, or why am I doing this Buddhist meditation? And maybe I should do yoga. Like this kind of not having this, being able to settle down. So desire can be a hindrance. So some ways that we can work with this, with desire. In one way is to look at this chain of events, this link that is involved with all aspects of desire. First, there's a sense of lack, a sense of incompleteness, or a sense of unsatisfactoriness. If you've been hanging around the Buddhist world, you know this, right? Sometimes we call this dukkha. But sometimes it's a real palpable, like something's missing. You know, this, like, very specifically a sense of lack. And then we have a desire to fill that sense of lack. And then from that desire, there's an action. It may be a physical action in the world, or it may be a mental action, or a verbal action, something we say or do. And then, of course, all actions have consequences. So a sense of lack that leads to desire, that leads to an action, that leads to a consequence. So we could look at all through this link, this chain here, to help us work with desire. We can work with anywhere in there, in those four steps, to help desire not be a hindrance, and to help us find skillful desires, and to use it in a way that support our life. So a sense of lack, how can we work with this? Sometimes it's helpful just to name it. Oh yeah, I feel, obvious ones, I feel hungry. Or I'm feeling lonely. Or whatever it may be. Sometimes it can be really helpful just to name it. Again, that can take some of the power away from it. Something active that we can do is to cultivate gratitude. It can be gratitude for anything, but just experiencing gratitude that we have a practice center and that people come together to practice, and there's a real sense of care and kindness I find here. And I have a lot of gratitude for that. So just thinking about gratitude kind of like fills you up in a certain way. You start to feel more a sense of abundance, or it's not the same, right, as a sense of lack. So what you have gratitude for doesn't have to be at all related to what the sense of lack is. It's just having gratitude in general for anything, whatever arises, whatever you have gratitude for, can help kind of dampen or maybe even alleviate the sense of lack. Also, it can be helpful that there is desire, and we have so many desires and so often, to notice if they ever lessen. If we examine them, we can notice that often they kind of ebb and flow, just like everything else in our lives. Sometimes they're stronger, sometimes they're weaker. And to notice if there's a sense of freedom, let's say this, an increased sense of freedom when the desire is on the downside. Just to notice this sometimes the absence of things we don't notice. It makes sense we don't notice. It's more difficult to see. But it can be really helpful to pay attention to that. And then that sense of freedom can counteract any sense of lack that we have. So those are some ways to work with this sense of lack. The next is to just work with desire itself. There's quite a few things that we can do here. The obvious one is to recognize it. Like, oh, this is what desire feels like. This is what's happening right now. So much of our practice is about just noticing what's actually happening right now. Sometimes that, again, can take a little bit of the power away from it. Once we recognize it, then we can check in. How does it feel in the body? For me, I know that when I'm desiring something, I'm often leaning forward, like physically leaning forward or putting my chin out a little bit. So it's this, it's quite remarkable, actually, to... Sometimes I know that, like, if I'm meditating and desire is, like, going crazy, and then I finally, like, kind of wake up to it, I find myself... just leaning forward, like, oh, okay. And sometimes even just that movement, that physical movement of getting back into a neutral stance can help kind of soften the desire too. It's remarkable how our bodies and minds are really connected. But also, there can be things in our mind too. If we are filled with desire, there may be a lot of like fantasy making, like, oh, it's going to be so great because this is going to happen and that is going to happen and I don't know what it is. There can be a sense of planning, like, oh, yeah, I got to make this happen or I got to buy this thing so I can buy it from here. It's probably on sale and then I can do this or, you know, I don't know. So when there's a lot of desire, there can be also kind of some movement of the mind too. So part of it is to recognize when it's happening, when desire is happening. Sometimes it's helpful to feel it in the body and recognize it in the mind. And then can we just be with it? Maybe it doesn't have to be a problem. Maybe that's just what's happening right then. And somehow if we can stop labeling, oh, this is a problem that shouldn't be here, and instead saying, oh, this is the truth of this moment, this is the reality. This is what's happening. This is what I have to practice with, this desire. That can be enormously helpful too. Just to kind of honor what's actually happening instead of making it a problem. Because sometimes, so unskillful desire often is, it's kind of, it can, we can be having unskillful, say unskillful desires because they maybe they'll cause harm to others, but we don't have to act on them. So if we can recognize them, then maybe we can just hold it. Maybe our minds can get big enough or we can somehow have our awareness big enough just to allow that awareness to, desire to be there. Maybe it's bouncing around and has a lot of energy, but we can be with it. So when we're experiencing desire, one way to work with it is to check in with ourselves, with our body and our mind. But also, it can be enormously helpful to look at the object of desire. Are we seeing it clearly? Most likely we're not. Most likely we're seeing the desirable aspects, right? This is kind of just human nature, and it's probably how... biology works to support us too, right? Is that we just start when we need something, food or whatever it may be. Our minds are kind of wired to just think about the how desirable that is. But one way is to look, just to ask ourselves, are we seeing it clearly? Are we seeing all aspects? Most likely there's some undesirable aspects to it as well. As well as if we're bringing to mind like, oh yeah, the last time I had a sugar powder donut, it was great. But we're not thinking about, oh yeah, maybe it was great, but the fleetingness of the idea, oh, that was great. Maybe you only thought it was great for, I don't know, the first bite. Maybe the second bite, and then, I don't know, sugar powdered donuts. I don't know how long it takes until you realize, wow, that happiness that I thought was going to be with that didn't last very long. So the fleetingness or the happiness that if we acquire or attain that object. And this is a skill. This actually takes practice to look at our objects more clearly, more thoroughly. Another way to work with desires is to just recognize, and this I want to acknowledge, we don't always have access to this. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. But we have competing desires, right? We have some is to be comfortable, but maybe we want to strengthen our meditation practice as well. That may mean sometimes being uncomfortable, because meditation isn't always comfortable. Sometimes it is, but not always. So we can just ask ourselves, okay, I have this desire, and then is this my highest priority to follow this desire? Do I have other things? I want to eat well. Maybe I want to eat the sugar powdered donut, and I also want to take care of my health. Which one am I going to follow? And I want to say that we don't always have access to that, because I know I don't. Sometimes, right? I have wisdom. I just don't have access to it all the time. And then one more thing that we could look at for desires, especially if they feel very compelling, if they feel really strong, they really have a pull or a push for us, is to gently inquire, is there something underneath this desire that's fueling it? Is there something that wants to be seen? Or maybe we have some beliefs. I have to have this in order to be happy. It may not be articulated so clearly, but we may be having some of these beliefs, or only when I have this will I be successful. Will people like me? Will I have some self-confidence? Or, you know, we may have some beliefs. Very often there's these types of beliefs that are unexamined that are fueling our desires. So there's a few ways to work with that. One is in meditation. You can choose maybe during a meditation period, if you feel like there's a lot of desire and it's really maybe tumultuous and you're feeling pushed around by it, you could just drop in a question without looking for the answer. That's the tricky part here. So right, you're meditating, so you're not looking for the answer. You're creating the conditions that the answer will arise. So that means it may or may not arise. You may find an answer and you may not. But looking for an answer, that's no longer meditation, that's more contemplation, which has its place and is appropriate, but that's not the same thing as meditation. So maybe when you're meditating, you find with desire, you could just very simply, and maybe just once, kind of just drop a question in. Is there something underneath this? Or what's fueling this desire? Or what's going on? And then just drop it in and then open up your awareness and relax and be with whatever happens. Maybe there'll be an answer, maybe not. But that's one way to kind of work with desires, is to see what's underneath them. You may find some of these beliefs. You may find, yeah, most likely it's beliefs. And those beliefs only show up in certain conditions. I don't know what exactly those conditions are. I don't think anybody does. It's different for all of us. So if we wanted to work with desire, we can, again, there was these four steps, the sense of lack, a desire, an action, and then a consequence. We've talked about how you can look at the sense of lack, you can look at the desire itself, and then the action. I've already touched on this a little bit, but is to examine, is this causing harm? That can help us to see, to take some of the attractiveness out of desire. If we can see, is this causing harm to myself, to others? Just to examine this. And then, of course, the consequence, maybe that's also about causing harm, but we could ask, did it really provide happiness? Did following this desire and doing this action, am I really happier now? Because often what happens, right, is maybe we'll have like a moment that the desire gets satisfied and then, boom, there's another desire right there. There's no real happiness in between there. And then we end up chasing, oh, there's, trying to satisfy our desire again, and then we just chase and chase and chase without finding happiness. So it can be really helpful. Like, did doing that really provide happiness? How long did that happiness last? That sense of ease last? And this can help us find skillful desires and unskillful desires. Skillful ones lead to happiness. It's a little bit more enduring, a little bit more stable. Things are impermanent, right? So naturally, until you're completely awakened, you don't have happiness all the time. I don't even know if people who are completely awakened, if they have happiness all the time. I don't know. But so not only was it happiness, but how satisfactory was that happiness? Right? There's kind of different levels of happiness. We could just inquire and ask ourselves this. And then, so here I am, I'm talking about, okay, desire is part of all of our experience. And Buddhist practice is about finding what's skillful and unskillful about desire. But it could also be completely natural to have some protests. Really? It feels like too much work. Can't I just be following my desires, just pursuing pleasure nonstop? Yes, of course you can. That is work. Thank you, Bill. That was a nice comment. Right? The more you practice, this is exactly what you start to see, right? This endless pursuit, right? It doesn't end. It doesn't end. It's exhausting. So, right effort, though, can be a way in which we harness desire. Like, we're going to have desire anyway, and right effort can be a way that we can use it in, put it to some, I wanted to say put it to use, but help it really to support us. Okay, let's harness our desire to help us create the conditions for wholesome, skillful states and qualities and diminish the unwholesome, unskillful states and qualities. So that gives you a way to work with desire and maybe not be pushed around about it so much. You're kind of a place to stand, like, okay, here's some desire. I'm going to see if I can put it to use in this context, in this particular way. And the Buddhist path does point towards greater and greater happiness. I can say I have so much more happiness, so much more contentment, so much more ease, joy, all these things since practicing, dedicating my life to the Dharma, essentially, doing a lot of meditation. It's like, wow. Yeah, it's like my former life is unrecognizable. So right effort is part of this path that generally is just leading us towards greater ease, well-being, peace, happiness, joy, contentment. It does take work, though. It does take work. But as Bill pointed out, endlessly pursuing pleasure after pleasure after pleasure, that takes work too. There may be a protest. Well, it's unnatural to manipulate our desires, or it's too goal-oriented, or we may have some protests about this too. But the truth is, I think all of us know this, right? That the way that living in a capitalist society, where there's plenty of advertisers out there, there are plenty of people who would love to manipulate your desires, who would love to increase your sense of lack. So why not kind of like take back some of that and say, okay, it's going to take effort to look at this, skillful and unskillful, and really look at whether things make me happy. But it's probably will lead you to a place where you want to go rather than where advertisers, you know, somebody on Madison Avenue or whomever wants you to go. And that can be empowering, right? As our lives go the directions we want it to go. And this idea that maybe it's too goal-oriented and maybe we should just be accepting what is, I think there's room for accepting what is. That's definitely where we start. We start with saying that this is the truth of the moment. This is actually what's happening. Desire is here. But this practice is not about passivity. It's not about just getting calm. It's about creating a life that has greater ease and happiness. And that does take some work. It does take some effort. But what a worthwhile, in my view, a worthwhile thing to do for ourselves to have greater ease and to create greater ease in the world with others. Support others, love others, have compassion for others, right? The more ease and peace and freedom we have, the greater our capacity to do that. So I used to think that, well, desire is, you know, I had heard this. Probably, I don't think I was here at IMC, but I had heard that the cause of all suffering is desire. And then I thought, well, what about the desire to end suffering? And then you get into this loop, like, that doesn't make any sense. So I would like to kind of reframe this. It's really about finding skillful and unskillful, and to acknowledge that desire is a natural part of all of our lives. Maybe even everything we do. And so let's just bring some awareness into this area so that it can support us and help us be the best versions of ourselves and create the life that we want. So I have the desire for all of you to have greater ease, peace, and happiness. Thank you.